Hi, Simon.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Good.
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 Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Simon Young, and you are in Hong Kong, a place from where you have joined us once before. But this time you're going to talk about some protests in Hong Kong that got a lot of attention. You are you're a professor of law at Hong Kong University and also an associate dean there. And I guess an observer of the Hong Kong scene. I guess my first question is, did you participate in the march, the demonstration?
No, not this year.
Not this year.
I know a number of my colleagues and my students did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is kind of a ritual, right? An annual ritual. I mean, it was the anniversary of the Hong Kong, of the handover of Hong Kong from Britain to China. And this protest was about, I guess, mainly changing the way the chief executive of Hong Kong is elected.
Yes.
That was the, and what's the issue here?
Well, that was just one of many issues.
No.
So there's a curtain process going on right now where, actually, when you step back and look at it from a more general perspective, it's really fascinating. I mean, Hong Kong has an opportunity to design its own system of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something for many, many years people here have wanted. And China has given us, since 2007, China has given us the green light and said that you can do this. And the year for the elections by universal suffrage is going to be 2017 for the chief executive.
So that will be like a direct vote for chief executive at that point?
That's right. And let me just sort of give you a bit more context, historical context. Since 1997, the chief executive has been elected by no more than 1,200 people. It was actually incremental. It started at 600, 800, and then 1,200. And that those 1,200 people are returned by no more than 250,000 people and companies. Hong Kong famously has something known as functional constituencies, where we give the vote to various business sectors, industrial sectors, including companies. And they return both legislators and also the people who elect the chief executive. And that 1,200 group is being known as the election committee.
Mm-hmm.
And it has two functions, one to nominate candidates and two to actually elect from the nominated candidates. And the question of how you nominate is becoming a very, very important issue in Hong Kong. But let me just explain how it works now. The system has always been that those 1,200 people, if 12.5% of them, about one-eighth of them, could nominate someone who qualifies to be a candidate,
mm-hmm.
Then they're in the game. And then that was always seen as a fairly liberal and low threshold for nominations. And so the last two times we had chief executive elections, quote-unquote, they had a fairly diverse group. So in other words, in Hong Kong, in a very simplistic way, we divide up the political camp in terms of the pro-establishment politicians and then the pan-democratic politicians. And in the last two elections, we were able to have one pan-democratic representative in the election.
What does pan-democratic mean here?
It means that these are individuals who would tend more to favor democracy and democratic change and be much more critical of the government and also critical of the central authorities in Beijing and be more willing to stand up for rights and you know, obviously had a great presence during the demonstrations and the marches that we've been seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to at least have one pan-democratic member in those elections. But of course, they had no chance of winning because the way that election committee is structured, it's strongly tilted in favor of the pro-establishment of the central government. Because as you can imagine, the business elements in this committee are very pro-China.
Yeah.
And that is a structure which, interestingly enough, is inherited from the British. But China obviously liked the structure after 1907 and wants to perpetuate that.
Okay, and so what we know is going to happen in 2017 is a shift toward what? What exactly does universal suffrage mean? I mean, is this committee going to still be in charge of nominating the candidates or what?
Right. So this is where we need to focus on the terms of the basic law. The basic law is a Chinese statute, which was enacted in 1990, but it didn't come into force in 1997. It serves as Hong Kong's constitution, mm-hmm. the 160 articles. And the most important article here to focus on is Article 45, because that's the article that talks about universal suffrage of the chief executive, described as an ultimate aim, but we now know that it can happen in 2017. But most importantly, it says that candidates for chief executive are going to be nominated by a nominating committee, mm-hmm. which is broadly representative, and in accordance with democratic procedures, right? And those are the words in that article. From China's point of view, they say that if nominations are going to take place, it has to be by this nominating committee. And China has also said that you can look to that election committee, which we've had since 1997, mm-hmm. as a model for the nominating committee. But immediately you can see the problem there.
Right, because if it's a very close model, then that will be an inherently conservative nominating committee. And given the fact that there's now going to be direct vote via universal suffrage, you can imagine that this nominating committee would no longer nominate these pan-democratic candidates, possibly, right?
Well, the crucial question is really the nomination method. Uh-huh. Because if we, in theory, stick with the existing nomination method, we're getting 1/8 of the nominations from that committee, and then mm-hmm. you're in, mm-hmm. we could still get a pan-democratic member running in the election, and then that would satisfy most people, I think. But here's the catch, is that so far, we don't know what that nomination method is going to be. Mm-hmm. China's already said that it's not going to be the same as before, that it may actually involve a system of voting, right? So, for example, if you qualify, then you can run in this mm-hmm. race for nomination, and then maybe the top three get the most votes.
As they make the election itself less restricted in participation, they may compensate for that by making the nomination procedure more restricted.
Exactly. And that raises then the issue that we were talking about, known as screening. Right, where Beijing wants to pre-screen candidates using this mechanism. And then, and as the pan-democrats are saying, you don't get a genuine election, mm-hmm. right? Because you're basically, you may get more than one candidate to choose from, but they're all people who've gotten approval from Beijing via this nominating committee mm-hmm. that is sort of, that is warped and strongly represents the pro-China interests. So that is really what the debate and the issues focusing on right now. And the other interesting thing to mention is while we're talking about different systems of nomination, it's now becoming very clear that there's a strong public view in favor of something known as public nominations or civic nomination, where we go outside of the committee, where you set a rule where, let's say, you get 1% of the population, the voting population, nominating someone, and that person automatically is in the race. Mm-hmm. That has become a very controversial issue because Beijing and also the Hong Kong government has said, well, there's no basis in the basic law for civic nomination. Basic Law 45 only talks about nomination by the nominating committee, mm-hmm. right? And then they would be inconsistent with the basic law, mm-hmm. right? But people haven't given up on civic nomination, even though we've gotten these very strong signals that civic nomination is not going to be possible. People haven't given up. In fact, it was just a few weeks ago that we had something known as a civil referendum. We don't have referendums in Hong Kong. They're illegal per se. But there are a number of civic society groups that were able to put together using technology and apps and computers, basically a civic nomination. And they had three options. Individuals had three options to choose from in terms of models for political reform. And all of the options involve some degree of civic nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond the total expectations of the organizers, they were able to get almost 800,000 people. So we're talking about a population of 7 million, but only about 3.5 million can vote. So, you know, almost one third of the voting population participated in this. And that's that sent a very strong signal, I think, to the government and the
nation. So the protests this year and the protests next year, I gather it's not, for the most part, a demand that anything in particular happen now. This is all in anticipation of something big happening in 2017 and an attempt to express a desire for this to be a broadly democratic kind of election system that is set up in 2017.
Now, I mean, it's not culminating up to 2017. Of course, 2017 is the year that it's supposed to actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, as you can appreciate, you've got to have the laws in place, right? And
right.
You've got to have the reforms approved before it can happen. And that really has to happen within the next couple of years.
Uh-huh. So it's getting interesting. So,
and yeah, let me just mention one more thing.
Sure.
Because it's crucial, because how is the reform going to take place? And this comes back again to the basic law, where there's an amendment formula in the basic law for changing the political system.
Mm-hmm.
And Beijing says that you have to pass this amendment formula if there's going to be any change. If you don't meet the three parts of this amendment formula, the system stays the same. What are the three parts? One, approval from Beijing, approval from the chief executive, which
mm-hmm.
are usually the same,
mm-hmm.
right? But most importantly is that you need two-thirds of the legislators accepting the proposal, right? And that is the critical element because, and we've seen in the past, that the pan-democratic they don't have a majority of seats in the legislature, but they do have enough for that one-third to have a veto
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
over any kinds of reform
mm-hmm.
proposal. They've used that veto once when we tried to change the system before, not for universal suffrage, but an incremental change.
Mm-hmm.
They used it once before. And then most recently, they were able to reach a compromise with the government and the central government, and we had some reform.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen that veto working in both ways. And that is the big mystery, really, that this story is sort of slowly unfolding, is will there be a sufficiently agreeable proposal to win over two-thirds of the legislature?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I take it, we haven't talked about this, but I take it that the chief executive must be pretty powerful if it's worth arguing so much about how the chief executive gets elected. Is it highly centralized? I mean, what does the chief executive have pretty much carte blanche or what in the way of governing Hong Kong?
Well, it's interesting because on paper, when you look at the basic law, right, the chief executive says that the chief executive is accountable to both the central government
mm-hmm.
and also to Hong Kong. So, in fact, it's probably the most difficult job that anyone has in Hong Kong because those are two interests that are, you know, they don't complement each other.
Uh-huh.
They're often in conflict. And what we've seen with our chief executives up to now is that the chief executive has often sided with Beijing. And in fact, in some instances, you know, just being served as a vessel of Beijing. Of
mm-hmm.
Beijing. And so, and then that raises a criticism that the chief executive isn't very powerful. It's just doing what Beijing tells him.
Right.
But I think there's a possibility, of course, another vision of the chief executive, where if that person, if we had the right person, you know, could serve a very dynamic mediating role.
Mm-hmm.
Mediating the Hong Kong interests with the central government's interests and serve as a real leader and someone who could command a lot of respect.
Well, does the chief executive have the power on paper to have a tremendous influence if he or she did defy Beijing? I mean, is it just that, is the deal that, yeah, the chief executive has a lot of power, but lots of chief executives take their marching orders from Beijing, or is it the case that actually their powers is not that intrinsically great?
Well, it's hard to say. I think it's a kind of power where it's power behind closed doors, where the chief executive could exert enormous amount of authority
mm-hmm.
Without being publicly defiant. Because if the central government trusts the chief executive, they will listen to him or her. And then likewise, that in Hong Kong, where you have a free press, that chief executive would have to also be able to, work within the Hong Kong context as well, and to demonstrate publicly leadership.
But I guess my question is, what kinds of decisions, in America, we might wait to hear who the president is nominating on the Supreme Court, then has to be approved by the Senate, but still it's a very important decision, and the president can veto legislation. And that's important. So what kinds of things can the chief executive do? Leaving aside the question of how under the influence of China the chief executive is, what kinds of decisions do you read about in the paper that the chief executive announces?
Yeah. So if you look at the structure of government under the Basic Law, it's often said that it's more like a presidential system than a parliamentary system. And in that sense, the chief executive is fairly powerful. He has his own executive committee, known as the Executive Council, which advises him, in which he has power to pick. Mm-hmm. He appoints judges. He appoints a group of the ministers, the principal officials. They don't have to be elected. Mm-hmm. So in fact, the chief executive does have an enormous amount of power, but subject to.
But what can he change about Hong Kong? Can he change the speed limit? Can he change laws about freedom of speech? What can he do?
The lawmaking powers of the chief executive are somewhat limited. Laws have to come from the legislature.
The Hong Kong legislature.
Legislature, but...
And is that elected?
Well, no. Okay. That's another part of the problem, right? It's only partially elected. We have 70 legislators, 35 are directly elected, 35 are returned by those functional constituencies,
right,
which has an electorate of about 250 for most of them. And then you've got five seats, so 30 and five seats that have a much wider electorate. And these were seats that were created in the last election, known as the super functional constituencies, where we compromised and we gave the public a lot more power to return those legislators. So we're talking about, 40 out of the 70 that have a more public mandate.
Okay.
But here's the thing, is that legislators have weak powers of policymaking and of introducing legislation, because anything that relates to policy has to come from the executive government. And that's where the chief executive...
In Beijing.
No,
the executive government in Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong. And that's the chief executive.
Okay.
There are certain things that have to be approved by Beijing. So some appointment of very senior judges have to be approved by Beijing. Mm-hmm. Same with the appointment of the ministers have to be approved by Beijing.
Well, that's a lot of power in Beijing.
Yeah. Historically, we haven't had too many difficulties, although when this current chief executive got into power, it was rumored that there were a few names put before Beijing for ministers, and Beijing did not approve them. So they have that kind of power. But of course, under the Basic Law, the theory is that Hong Kong is supposed to have a high degree of autonomy, and Beijing is supposed to stay out of most things, or if they're going to act, they should act through the Hong Kong officials. But in the last few years, and this has been another cause of sort of tension, we're starting to see more sort of Chinese intervention that's direct, not going through the officials indirectly. And then there was the Chinese white paper, which came out just about a month ago. And in this white paper, it was put out by the State Council, so very high authority in Beijing. And it was a white paper on the practice of one country, two systems. And it was meant to give an account, from the horse's mouth of how one country, two systems has been working. And when you read the document, it paints the whole story in a very glowing light, particularly focusing on economic impact, right? And not really talking about, all the problems that we've had with past chief executives and governance. And then the most controversial parts of this white paper talked about, referred to judges as administrators of Hong Kong in the same breath as referring to the executive branch of government. And that really got people rattled here, you know, thinking that, you know, because one of the best things about Hong Kong we've had is the independence of the judiciary. And those kinds of statements have really sort of rattled people up here. And then there's other, if you, the overall theme of this paper is really, you know, don't forget that this is only this one country. And don't think that you are, you know, separate or autonomous region. It comes back to Beijing. And it had that very strong message, China exercising a comprehensive jurisdiction, exercising powers of oversight over Hong Kong. And again, that really rattled up people. And that was really one of the main causes for why so many people turned out on July 1st.
And as a practical matter, has liberty been declining over the years since the takeover in terms of freedom of the press and the freedom people feel to speak out?
Yeah. Well, let's put freedom of expression aside for a moment. On other things, you know, generally things have been fairly good, mostly for two reasons. One,
what are the other things you mean by aside from freedom of expression?
Yeah, so civil and political rights, you know,
so like criminal justice process, rights, due process of law, and
exactly due process, you know, even property rights, socioeconomic rights. That's generally pretty good, primarily because our constitutional instruments. We've got a Bill of Rights, we've got a Basic Law. They protect these fundamental rights. And our courts have interpreted these rights in a robust way and, like in the U.S., have exercised constitutional review, so striking down things. And people have noticed that and have brought, you know, cases to court. So, in fact, if you look in the area of asylum law and refugee law, I mean, it's like night and day from before 1997 and now. We've got a fairly decent system of asylum law protection. Right. Now, let's turn to freedom of expression. In my own view, and people may have different views, but my own view is on the whole, it's been fairly good. Again, mostly because of that, the, you know, the safety net that we have with the courts and the rights protections. But as a matter of practice, you if you speak to Journalists Association, they have noticed in the past couple of years things getting a lot more tougher, and state and Chinese government coming out and saying things that. That sort of serve as a chill, have a chilling effect.
Like what kinds of things?
Press. Well, you know, the certain things about you know what you should and should not report on,
So like what kind of thing might the state say? Might China say you shouldn't report on?
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking of a few examples here. Well, the Journalists Association recently came out. And there was, of course, as a result of the demonstrations, there were the arrests, and it also sort of involved some of the journalists were also involved in that, and hence they journalistic freedom they felt was interfered with while the arrests were taking place and how things could be reported on. Also, there was reference to just how government officials, Hong Kong government officials, have in doing their interviews have really sort of limited press time and haven't really come out and said you know, answered questions as much as the journalists would like.
We get that here too. But,
yeah.
So, but the coverage of a protest themselves are is I mean, journalists feel a little constrained. I mean, what do journalists fear? They fear they could get that. What would happen to them if they covered protests or arrests or something in a way that didn't please China?
Yeah. No. I don't think, I mean, there's always been this talk about sort of self-censorship by some of the certain media we have, particularly concerned about business interests in mainland. That's always, you know, been a concern. But I don't think, I mean, I think the journalists, it's not so much about reporting, but it's a certain you know, maybe it's more difficult for me to sort of speak for the journalists,
right.
But there was a certain report that just came out by the Journalists Association saying that, you know, we've been going through some very difficult times recently. I mean, it's not so much that, you know, that the Hong Kong government would have any sort of threats or prosecute journalists. It's not that bad. That's why, you know, I started off by saying on the whole, I think things are good. But it's just sort of this perhaps a feeling that, you know, that you know, you may not be able to cover particularly things that may be taking place in the mainland as mm-hmm. well in the same way as before.
Okay. So there were a lot of protesters out on the streets, more than 100,000, some say several hundred thousand. But there were a lot of people who weren't out on the streets. There, you know, there are people on the other side of this argument in Hong Kong. You've suggested that business interests are on the other side, are conservative in this way. Is there anything else you'd say kind of sociologically about the kinds of people who want this robust democratic change versus the kinds of people who are more on the conservative side of the argument? Is there an age difference or anything else?
Yeah. I don't want to generalize too much because I haven't read any studies of people trying to break down who actually comes out. But, you know, as a sort of general observation, it's very clear that young people have a strong presence
mm-hmm.
at the July 1st march. And it's very clear that we have a lot of young people who are pushing for this civic nomination
mm-hmm.
reform. There's a group known as the Scholarism Group, made up of not even university students. They're mostly high school students.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were very active when they were protesting against the national education proposals. That was 2 years ago. In fact, that's where they really came together and demonstrated that they could be a very important force for change in this community, because they actually succeeded in getting government to back down mm-hmm. on its proposal. And so now we see them again, because they attribute kinds of initiatives like national education as, you know, kinds of things that the Hong Kong government would try to get away with because we don't have democratic a foundation mm-hmm. in Hong Kong. So now they're pushing for a strong democratic system of electing the chief executive. So the Scholarism Group, then the university students as well, are also organizing. So that is a very strong force now, which we hadn't seen before in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have, you know, in fact, June, it's not just July 1st, it's also June 4th, when people come out in sympathy of the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there was a large turnout for the annual vigil, mm-hmm. Candlelight vigil.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings out not only young people, but interestingly enough, a lot of the mainland people who've now migrated to Hong Kong, they'd like to come to that as well, because they weren't exposed. They weren't allowed to do that in the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
So that, interestingly enough, on June 4th is a strong voice. And then you have individuals back to July 1st who are just upset with other government policies. And another recent issue is the issue that government wants to expand housing in certain areas of northern Hong Kong, the new territories, and creating new towns that may cause people to have to move in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a very controversial issue. And people were coming out on that issue as well. Right. So what you get is, you know, large pockets of different groups in the community that are upset with different aspects of government policy. And you have got the more radical pan-democratic legislators
mm-hmm.
Who are, you know, pushing very local and domestic issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's oftentimes in tension with mainland visitors, because that's another problem that we have here is that since 2003, as we've been trying to form closer relationships with the mainland, particularly on economic issues. I mean, we've had an influx of mainland visitors to mm-hmm. Hong Kong, But that, you know, has been a double-edged sword. Yes, it's been good for the economy, but socially, it's given rise to a lot of tensions. And so you have a number of groups that are, trying to push that back as well.
So is it easy for people in the mainland to visit Hong Kong and then go back to the mainland to live there?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like that it's in 1997. I mean, it was a very tight sort of border.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't think that China would open it up too much because in the Pacific Law itself, it talks about, you know, that, you know, we would have strict immigration controls.
Mm-hmm.
And it was felt that, you know, Hong Kong is already a small place. If you were to do that, it would really change.
Also, I'm a little surprised that China wouldn't be worried that people from the mainland would visit Hong Kong, like the freer atmosphere there and the greater freedom of the press, and go back to the mainland and, you know, agitate for those things, right? So I'm a little surprised if China makes it really easy for people to go back and forth.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. I think their attitude is that they recognize that they themselves, you know, have been liberalized. I mean, not to the same extent, but in terms of economic freedoms, you know, that certainly has changed a lot. And also, I mean, most of the visitors are people who come from Guangdong or Shenzhen. And so if you go there now, I mean, the development that you've seen, the economic development that you see there, almost indistinguishable from Hong Kong, but not the same political or other freedoms. But we've had a few instances of possible influences. I mean, no doubt it has impact, but I think the mainland authorities think that they can control that.
Yeah.
And people are generally happy with the economic freedom.
I mean, according to the reporting here, China itself has, if anything, gotten more restrictive lately when it comes to things like, you know, internet, freedom of the internet, and freedom of speech, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We're very concerned about that here. I know there's a case that I'm watching closely involving a lawyer who survived Tiananmen Square, was a student in Tiananmen Square, and has now been in custody as a result of the June 4th, the recent June 4th that's just passed. Yes, there's a lot of concern about those things even here, and. I don't know. I think people, the Hong Kong, the mainland individuals, they recognize that they're two different places altogether, and that when they're in Hong Kong, they, you know, they like the freedom, but when they go back to the mainland, they probably recognize that, well, you know, this is a different place, and you know, it may have on a longer term perspective, it may have more influence. I think immediately mainland authorities seem to think that they can control. The interesting thing to watch actually is how Hong Kong is influencing our sister special administrative region, Macau, because there are some really interesting developments happening there.
Was that handed over at the same time that Hong Kong was?
2 years later, 1999.
Uh-huh.
And on this very similar kind of arrangement. They also got a basic law, and also the idea of a high degree of autonomy. They historically have been a lot closer to the mainland. And historically, have been, the people there have been much more willing to, you know, accept the mainland policies or the leaders of Macau put in by Beijing, except what's been going on there, without too much discontent, primarily because economically it's been doing well with the casinos. However, you know, they're so close to us and they get so much exposure to us in Hong Kong that in the last year we've seen the rise of demonstrations.
Hmm.
Not the same scale as Hong Kong, because Macau is a much smaller place, but comparable to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this year was a year where the people rose and demonstrated to such an extent that it caused the Macau government to back down on a piece of legislation,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the legislation was very controversial to begin with, proposing to confer some kind of immunity from prosecution to the chief executive, implications about public revenue because proposals to give them certain payments after they leave office, etc. That was highly controversial with the Macau people. They protested it, government backed down. And now they're thinking, well, you know, this works. And the Hong Kong people have been doing it for a number of years now. And then they're starting to see it's the people power idea that's starting to inform what's going on there as well.
I mean, the funny thing is, I gather that even in China itself, protest of a kind has had a big influence, if only on a local level, right? Like out in the country, people get really upset if, a lake is turns out to be poisoned or you hear about a lot of that kind of unrest. I mean, on the other hand, if you show up at Tiananmen Square on the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, you know, you're going nowhere. But there is a certain kind of activism in China that the government is actually responsive to, right?
Yeah. I agree with that. But I think it has to be coordinated with the kinds of policies that they have in place. So right now we've got this sort of big sort of anti-corruption campaign that's going on. And just in the news today, there was someone who had caught an official who involved in let me put it, it's not just anti-corruption, but also that sort of it's a campaign that's trying to secure greater integrity in officials. So the story today was not about corruption per se, but it had an official who was sexually harassing someone on the subway, and someone had caught it on their camera.
Oh, really?
Phone camera, and it just sort of went viral. And that person now has lost his position in the Communist Party.
And this is in China, mainland China.
In China, this is in China. It's a really interesting example of how someone, whoever caught this, they probably may not even known who that person was.
Yeah.
But it was such an obvious scene of sexual harassment. Someone, the official, was touching the woman's leg. It was just so obvious. And then this person is of some importance. And now he's been sort of derobed of all his political power, but that's, I think, in line with this the Xi Jinping government administration of anti-corruption and also higher integrity. It's with its officials, and so it fits with that. Yes, I think that's fine, and that's a good policy too. But yeah, if it's other things where you're perhaps criticizing and you're asking, demanding greater human rights and freedoms, then it doesn't fall necessarily within a policy.
So as of now, there's just a big difference between how freely things circulate on the internet in Hong Kong versus China, what the media can cover. So I assume that coverage of Chinese politics is much more illuminating in Hong Kong than what you'll see in the media in China, and that there's much less censorship on the web, and you can read the New York Times more easily and search for more things on the internet, right? And there's a very clear-cut difference, right?
Very clear cut, and people who go to China say that getting onto Google is very difficult,
right?
In mainland, yeah.
Right. Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground. I have one more question. You said that business, the system is set up now in Hong Kong to give a lot of power to business interests in the nomination, in the selection of the chief executive. And I gather those interests are by and large opposed to the kind of liberalization that the protesters favor. Do you have a sense for what the business interests are afraid would happen if there were more, if the election of the chief executive were more directly responsive to popular will?
Well, there is a sort of feeling that Hong Kong becomes a welfare state. Hong Kong more responsive to the people, and then Hong Kong, of course, is a place where you have a real problem with poverty. People may not know this, but a real divide between the rich and the poor, And that's partly because of previous government policies, even going back to the British policies. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things may change. And as that is the case, then, you know, economically, the government won't be as strong, and then maybe greater demands, taxes, et cetera,
right,
on business. I mean, that's maybe part of the thinking. But I also think it's simply, you know, if you're already in a privileged position, why give it up?
Right.
Right.
You just don't want things to change generally.
Exactly.
But it sounds like, in particular, they don't want them to change in a way that Mao Zedong would have approved of, right?
Yeah, that's the irony, isn't
it? Yeah, it really is. But I guess that's the situation. Okay, well, thank you so much, Simon. This is I've learned a lot from this.
My pleasure.
And maybe we'll check in down the road to see how things are going, if you've got time.
The story is still unfolding. You know, this is really one of the most interesting moments in Hong Kong's history.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone here is waiting really for the government, for the central authorities,
mm-hmm,
really to try to do something to lower the temperature, because I don't think it's been as hot, you know, literally, in politics than ever before.
Okay, well, we'll keep our eye on it. Well, I am going to go to sleep now. You have a nice day there where it's early in the morning.
All right, have a good evening.
Okay, take care.